That's where we always start, because that's where it's got to start. You can only change yourself, and hopefully enough people are motivated and inspired to do that. And working together, we could even affect some change, because it's always been that small, dedicated, committed minority that's affected any change. Roger Sales Radio Ranch, here we go, live show, September the 9th of 2015, right almost in the dead center of what promises to be a memorable month. I'm really happy about today's show because of the topic and the person that I get to deal with here today that we get to enjoy, and that is one really brave young woman from Chicago area named Deanna Spingola. Deanna, welcome to the Radio Ranch. I'm really tickled to death to have you today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I was on your show one time back several years ago, right after the book was published, and then we've had some email exchanges and whatever, but the other day one of my old listeners, and trusted friend John, said you ought to get Deanna on, and all this stuff is coming to such an interesting apex, and the area that you have specialized in and really dedicated yourself to takes, for one thing, a lot of guts. So my hat's off to you, because I know this trail and path can be very treacherous.
Well, thank you. Indeed. Actually, you were on twice. You were on my program in 2013, I believe, on February 19th. And again on, back in 2013.
Okay, well, I missed one, so I'm staying corrected, and I know we talked about my stuff when I was there, and I wanted to, now that I've got a show, I've never had taken the chance to get you on before, because I want to talk about your stuff and how it interlaces and the background, because, you know, when you start getting into anything, I want to ask you in a minute how you woke up and everything, just your whole history to get to this point in a nutshell. But when you wake up and you start looking around, any good newspaper journalist uses the 5 W's, you know, who, what, when, where,
sure,
and why. And the most important of those are who and why, when you really get down to it. And those were my thoughts 24 years ago when I woke up, and I've come to, after many, gosh, hundreds of thousands of hours of study and thought, come to some definite conclusions that are based in fact. But your path has been really interesting to me, and you've specialized a lot in the war and some of the other stuff, but you've really researched these guys thoroughly too. For how many years, and what happened to bring you into reality?
Several years ago when my children were young. Let's start back before that. I began to do family history research when I was maybe 19. And I discovered that my second great-grandfather was killed at Antietam. And the other name for that that particular place is Sharpsburg. That's what the Southerners call it. And then I discovered that because of his death and because of the northern aggression against the South, that it really affected families. And I saw from generation to generation how that war affected my own personal family, my own personal life. And so war, particularly beginning with the Civil War, has always been fascinating to me. And then later on, when I had children, I knew something was wrong. I mean, it was just very obvious to me that things were wrong. And so I decided that, well, I needed to do something. So I joined the John Birch Society. And then I thought, well, you know, they talk a lot about the UN. They were talking about the UN. And
putting up all those billboards and stuff around the country.
Yes. I mean, I thought, wow, this is going to really help. But it never did. It never progressed. And then I didn't really, I was the secretary for the local group and everything. And we sent out all kinds of letters and just all kinds of things. And then I began to talk to my friends about these things, and my friends were absolutely not interested in the least. And, in fact, I lost some friends.
I was going to say, they really start alienating from you.
Yeah. I've lost so many friends.
Oh, no.
I've lost relatives and friends. And
boy, I just really resonate with what you're saying, and you've already hit on about three or four important things, but I want you to continue because this is real interesting to me, and I think the audience too.
But anyway, I continued raising my kids, and then I read, for one thing, I read None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen.
What year did you read that? Can you just have a general idea?
Gosh, in the 70s.
Ooh, you were really way back there.
Yeah, when you said that you were happy to have a young woman from Chicago, and I thought, whoa, that's cool.
Well, we try and be nice to our guests here, except for my Tuesday co-host, Tom, and I know him so well that we get into these Oscar and Felix things. But, I'll tell you what, no matter how young you are at heart or anything else, this battle right here will age you.
Oh, absolutely. It will make you sick. It will do all kinds of things to you. It will, anyway. it will bring all kinds of attacks. Also.
So you got awoken up by looking at None Dare Call It Conspiracy or Treason, whichever one it was, by Gary Allen back in the 70s, that Bob Chapman worked with him very closely on, the late Bob Chapman, by the way.
Oh.
I remember hearing him say that numerous times. But so I like you, and I was a kid in the 60s, and just knew when I was in college and all those years that something wasn't right. I never knew what it was till 20-something years later and I found the tax movement, or even longer than that. But so like you, I had that sense. It's not something, just isn't right. You can't put your finger on it, see?
Sure. And I was never a part of the, I didn't involve myself with popular music. I totally missed that because to me it was just a bunch of noise. So I didn't get involved with any, I didn't become a fan of any music group or anything like that, which I think I'm so grateful for. I'm very grateful for that because I think it was a huge distraction and it was a huge operation against the youth of this country. But anyway,
let me stop you. You know that I spent 10 years professionally in the big time music business. That was my career for a company, the first, at least half of it almost, out of Chicago, Mercury Records, right down there by those two round buildings downtown in the IBM building was where their offices were.
Wow.
So that's, I guess, where our paths split. But go ahead.
So anyway, when Ross Perot was running, I thought, well, I'm just going to go and support him. So I worked at the campaign office, and then just within a short period of time, I thought, gosh, you know, what are his connections? Why did he run, and what's the deal here? So, if you're a politician, you're corrupt. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. So, anyway, I tried to do the things that I thought would be productive. And they were educational things that I was involved with, and I did learn a lot. And then, of course, after 9/11, then I really got back into it big time and began writing essays or articles on the internet in January of 2005. And I'm still here.
When did you start your radio show? You're on once a week is now?
I started that in October of 2010. I was just finishing up what I thought was my was a book that somebody, that a publisher was going to publish, and it turned out that he reneged, because I guess I used the J word too much. And so and this was 2 weeks before he was supposed to really get it out. He called me up, and it was a Saturday afternoon. I was shocked, and he wanted to assign me an assistant, and this assistant that he wanted to assign me had never before written a book, and I read some of her articles on the internet. I thought, oh, she's a cover-up artist, and he wants me to listen to her, have her be my mentor? I don't think so.
She's going to sanitize you.
Of course. Well, actually, it's really funny. The only reason I started writing a book is because two publishers actually approached me within 2 days' time. And this was back in December, December of 08. Yeah, 08. And asked me if I would write a book, and it was based on the articles that I had written. And, gosh, I was flattered. And so I decided to go with the first publisher. And in our conversations, he told me that his father had been a CIA agent. I thought, oh, that's nice. I think it's being a CIA agent is kind of like being in the mafia, that it can be a generational thing, and it can also be like the mafia. Well, in that you don't actually ever leave, that you're just there all the time. But anyway, I ended up deciding that I would publish my own book. So I worked on it. And
it's quite an undertaking, isn't it, writing a book?
Yes. And when they asked me, then I decided to go with the one publisher. Then I worked on the book, and then right before it was supposed to come out, then he said, no, we're not going to do it. I went away a year. And so then I worked on it on my own. And, but then at the end of 2010, in October, I thought I was pretty well, had the book done. And actually I divided it up into a trilogy, because it was going to be really excessively long, because I tend to put a lot of details into what I do. And so anyway, I thought I was pretty well done with my writing. And so I approached RBN, because I had been a guest on RBN with Rick Adams and some other people. And I said, you really need a woman's voice there. All of your hosts are men, or most of your hosts are men. You need a woman's voice. And so John Stattmiller thought about it, and he gave me a slot on Saturday night at 9 o'clock, which was, it was good. And I was there for a couple of months, and then he gave me a Monday through Friday program for 1 hour. And so that went along until last year, 2014. Then I got just a one-day-a-week program. And then I also have a blog talk radio program of my own that I do twice a week.
I wanted to bring the blog talk in there. I saw that on some of the stuff I had seen. And you mainly, in the shows I've heard, and I've heard some great information on your shows, over the years. Some of you have fabulous guests, these people. I have no idea where you find them. That bring so many important things to the table, historical and factual. Let me tell you a couple of things I've learned. One thing, I had that same thing happen with the J word, actually on one of our radio, Patriot Radio programs, because I had mentioned it when I was on a weekly basis, and it was sponsored by a gold dealer. And the next week, when I was getting ready to go on, I got a message that said, don't say the word Jew. They got calls. And I wrote back and said, well, who called? The ADL or Southern Poverty Law Center? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you get that kind of in our own movement where you can't even use the word because they've got so many defenses built into it. So this is the point I wanted to get to with you because I'd like to bounce this off of you. We've coined a whole new phrase for these guys. When you go in and analyze it and you know something about it historically, they're not Jews. And it's, Jesus says that right there in Revelation in red letter Bibles. So, so they got this thing called Zionism started and they dart back and forth between those and use them conveniently as a defense. Mm-hmm. But a couple of years ago, you know who Gilad Altman is, obviously. And one of his postings one time, there was a video in there. It was done obviously in Hebrew, I believe, but it had English subtitles to it. And in the first part of that were actual excerpts out of Theodor Herzl's personal diary. Have you ever seen those?
Well,
let me tell you what Herzl envisioned Zionism as. His idea, I could drag it up and read it for the whole audience. Audience who listens is kind of familiar with it. We touch on it occasionally. But Herzl really admired the Gentile, if you will, world, to their advancement and their culture and all of their different things that his traditional Jewish ghetto society and culture did not have. And so he really wanted to assimilate into that. And his original idea was to mass convert the Jews to Catholics all at one time on a big parade on Sunday at St. Stephan's Cathedral in Vienna, one of the, I guess, great cathedrals in Europe, with the Pope in attendance, if he could get him there, with balloons and bands. That was Theodor Herzl's idea of Zionism. So now, obviously, that's not what we've got. So they've hijacked it the way they hijack everything else. So who are these guys? Back to our five W's, all right? Well, they're using Babylonian debt monetary system, highly sophisticated from those days, but that's the mechanism. And they're using the Babylonian merchant code, which we now call the Uniform Commercial Code. So when they're using the money and the finances, they're the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
And so, except that now, 2,000 years later, they got all this technology and they're real slick, see, even slicker than they were back in those days, and they're parasites. Mm-hmm. So what I did was take the word Pharisee and parasite and coined a phrase, Pharisite.
Oh, that's very clever.
Now we can pin the tail right on the bastards and they can't hide.
Sure.
Okay.
Yes. Well, I've had some interesting experiences with them coming after me. Back in 2011, I was using a song. I just used this song. It was freely available on the internet. And I thought, well, I'm going to use this. And I only used it for probably 3 weeks. But RBN got a phone call from a New York lawyer threatening to sue RBN for $250,000 if I did not stop using this song. And I also got an email from the New York lawyer. And so it was not the song. It really was not the song. But what it was the subject matter of my programs. They were just trying to shut me down.
They peck, peck, peck wherever they can. That's an intimidation, of course, tactic, and it's totally typical of psychopaths, which they are.
Sure.
I was the one that gave you, remember the troll that used to call into your show all the time?
Which one?
Well, the one, he always uses different voices. The one, Russ from Minnesota, whose real name is Russell Estes, and he's the graphic designer for the Sodomy Pedophile Larceny Center, as I call him. The Southern Poverty Law Center. He does their publications that they send out to all these police departments they've corrupted all over the damn country.
Oh my gosh. I did not know that was his last name.
Estes. Wow. Russell Estes. He's probably in the Minneapolis St. Paul area. I've oftentimes floated the idea that anybody and listeners up there, he's probably listed in the phone book. Let's go spy on his ass.
Wow. Wow. And he was on my email list and we've exchanged emails. He's very clever. He's also very crude. I mean, he said some really awful things on John Stadtmiller's program. And he does have an awful lot of time to listen to talk radio or to the alternative media.
Well, that's his job. And you see,
that is his job.
He monitored, he caught me right in the first couple of shows, and I busted him real early there because he was trying to rail on my information and demonize me for selling a book. Hell, the book wasn't till 8 months later. I was just putting it together, and because I used to be an MLM. And those were the two things that he tried to hammer on. And, but that's how I busted him. A friend of mine, I was telling him that story about these emails and these calls and stuff and getting on other shows. And, my friend said, well, I was just in a police station the other day and I picked up one of those little publications. I think I've still got it around here. I said, well, go find it. And he opens it up. Is there anybody there named Russ? He says, right here, Russell Estes, graphic designer or whatever. And then a whole bunch of other names. And I said, is there another Russ there? Nope, isn't another one. So I got on the air and called him out.
Wow.
I've never heard a peep out of the little slime ball since.
He has called into programs and claimed that my husband is a Freemason and has claimed all kinds of things. And just to create doubt about my credibility.
That's all they can do. They always try and do the ad hominem attack because they can't attack the facts. And that's how they use deflection technique. And we're going to try and get into depth and expose them a little bit today, Deanna. I'm tickled to death to have you on the show, man.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I covered this in my second book, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power, and talked about their background. I should have sent you a PDF of that book. But, yeah, I talk about the Khazars, and there are people who are now saying, oh, no, they're not Khazars. But, yes, they really are. And certainly the resources, the citations that I use, kind of prove that they are really Khazars. They have absolutely no genetic connection to the land that they have stolen from the Palestinians.
That's correct. And let me tell you, from my 10-plus years and at more after that in those circles of being in the music industry, I came in contact with an awful lot of Jewish people. It's chock full of Jews, okay? And some of them became some of my very closest friends. I had a Jewish roommate who was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jew, and his last name was the only one in the New York phone book. He used to be real proud of that, and he's as good a guy as you could ever be around, and literally.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've come to understand in what I mentioned to you in the one little exchange we had about subject matter, because I wanted today to be spontaneous, was the split off something like Zionism has been hijacked, as I referenced earlier, to the same way that Judaism has been hijacked by these Sabbateans and these Frankists. And it's an absolute specific sect in there that goes back to around the 1500s, I believe, when one of these chief rabbis said, well, the whole world needs to be rebuilt, it has to be torn down first. And so he took a philosophy of everything opposite from good. And that's the sect that started with a guy named Frank, I believe was his name, and it's morphed into the Sabbateans, and that's who we're dealing with, is that sect right there. And they keep darting back and forth behind this Jewish, all of this myth and misinformation and historical whatever, and they keep hiding back there, and that's why they need to be separated out and identified. And you can do that by their tactics.
There have always been factions within the so-called Zionist movement that were led by particular people. And you often hear that if you have three Jews in a room, that they're going to have four different arguments, or something of that effect. Yes, they don't always agree on the tactics that they use. And I don't go back that far. As far as history, I pretty much start before the so-called Civil War, talk about Andrew Jackson and his connection to the Rothschilds in London. And he did have connections to the Rothschilds.
Oh, I don't nothing would surprise me almost anymore. I've come to some whole new approaches on understanding that whole period of time, though. And really, my understandings have evolved since you and I spoke the last time on your program. So it may be that we could float some of those today, because I think I know now the real reason for the Civil War, and that was to institute the 14th Amendment so they could institute this system they've got us in 150 years later.
Absolutely. The corporatocracy.
That's just got to be it. And we're approaching a break here real quick. We'll probably get jumped on by some bumper music in a second, but we can certainly continue that line of discussion over in the second segment. For the audience, what I'd like to do is just have this conversation with Deanna a little bit at the front end of the show, and maybe in the last hour we could open up the phones if any of you wanted to call in, make comments, or whatever the heck you want to do. Deanna Spingola, Roger Sales Radio Ranch. Be right back.
There was a woman in Georgia, didn't feel just right. She had fever all day and chills at night. Now things got worse, yes, a serious thing. In times like this, the days of man is a style like getting out of them vine.
Yep, a doctor of the heart and a doctor of the mind. That may be what you have today. We will see as we go forward. Deanna Spingola, my special guest on the Radio Ranch. Live show September the 9th, 9-9. 9-9-15, no less. That even looks ominous. I wanted to tell the listeners on that news break there, they were talking about all the number of sharks over there on the eastern seaboard. Well, let me tell you what, you better, if you're on land, you better watch out. There's more of them walking around amongst you than there are out there swimming, I promise you.
And exactly. I was thinking the same thing.
Those are the people that we're kind of talking about today, are these land sharks that absolutely do nothing but destroy. Comment on something you said in your introduction, Deanna, a little bit of your history. You were real involved with JBS for a few years. A lot of people have been. You know, they certainly have some aspects, a lot of things they do with excellence. Their writing, their magazine, some of the topics they do cover. They just don't ever seem to give the whole story. I wondered if you were familiar with the now deceased Colonel Jack Moore.
I've heard of him, of course, but no, I was.
Well, for the audience that didn't know, this is one of those things that really exposes JBS, in all honesty. And Colonel Moore was the first person captured in Korea by the North Koreans in the Korean War. And was held through that whole conflict and tortured psychologically, etc. They went to shoot him about, I don't know, 5-6 different times. They'd give him his last meal, let him smoke a cigarette or whatever, take him out blindfolded, set him up, ready, shoot, fire, and the guns would fall on empty chambers. That kind of stuff.
Wow.
And he was released and came back, obviously, at that point in John Birch's infancy, being an anti-communist organization, he very quickly became the most popular speaker of their speakers bureau.
Mm-hmm.
And when he first went out and started talking about and woke up to Zionism and started tying in the Zionism knot, he got about 3 or 4 stops into that tour, and they yanked him off the tour in Little Rock, and he never spoke for John Birch again.
Well, you know, that same exact thing happened to James Perloff. Jim was writing for them, had some couple of books, well, at least one book that I know of, published with them. And he started talking about the Jews, and they just dismissed him immediately.
Boom, boom. Evidently from Eustace Mullins' writings in one of the books I read of his, that was founded by money. The Welch was the founder, mm-hmm. and he had his family was the Welch Candy Heirs, which he sold the company to the Rockefellers, and
right.
that John Birch never had an overdrawn check at Chase Manhattan Bank.
Exactly.
Controlled opposition, another tactic very common and used extremely effectively by these creeps. So we were talking about the Sabbateans and all that. Your familiarity isn't that back. You know how I found out about that? I've just got a big curious about these guys. Well, you know, and until you know origins and some history, you don't really have a full picture. And the first person I heard talking about this subject was on Rents, is a Jew that's been, but they won't let him back into Israel, is Barry Chomish.
And, oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And I heard him bring this out. That's the first time I'd ever heard it. I've researched it over the years a little bit, and, you know, I know enough to understand that there's some real big origin magic there and that whole story, and it explains a lot of why and how they do what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But they use these words, you know, where they've got a double definition, like classic example was Lloyd Blankfein a couple of years ago after 2008 when they're stealing everybody's houses, and he gets up there in front of the national media and says they're doing God's work. Well, he knows exactly which God's work they're doing.
Right.
But it's all the other people that don't. And it's that I finally got the word for what they do, Deanna, from one of our guests last week, Josh, God bless you. The term equivocation is how they're doing what they do. And that means taking a word that's got a double meaning and using it out of context. And that's exactly what they do, and they switch your thoughts to the dialectic definition. Boom. That's how they create this illusional world. So knowing that's their technique, you just go back and identify the words and start untying them, and you bring yourself into reality. So it's all what they do, I've come to understand. They call, and I know you've seen it referred to, magic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all these little tricks.
It's interesting that you bring this up. I had a guest on my Saturday program, Dennis Wise, and he is the creator of The Greatest Story Never Told, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. And he's currently working on something called Communism by the Back Door. And he has only 10 parts so far, and it's a work in progress. I will put the link to it in your Skype box. And he talks about a lot of this. He talks about the music business. He talks about Freemasonry. He talks about Hollywood. And by the time that you watch these parts, I mean, you're just overwhelmed at the deception and at the very public display that they use. And yet, I mean, I'm aware of this. I was aware of this, but Dennis has done such a fabulous job of putting it together so that you see it visually. It's shocking. By the time you go through these, there are actually 10 parts, but by the time you go through these 10 parts, you're just feeling pretty overwhelmed, actually.
Well, you know, I don't know that you've ever seen the video I did a couple of years ago for Ed Snowden, but in the middle of it, I'm sure I sent it to you. I don't know if you saw it or, you know, whatever. That period of my life was pretty chaotic there for a while. The middle of that video, sitting in at this desk in this very position a couple of years ago on May the 1st of 2015, over a 2-week period of time of real intense pressure in my life, I was given the Holy Grail. It's in that video in the middle of it. And it's demonstrated and diagrammed from my knowledge for the first time in history. Okay? And what the Holy Grail, the Freemason motto is this: first a line, then another line, then a square.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what they're doing is they're getting you thinking linearly.
Right.
And when you think to see the word square, you go through this equivocation, and most people think a square. But a square is a drafting term when you close off two lines. So the Holy Grail, and this is in that video, it's right in the middle, it's superimposed over the pyramid with the all-seeing eye, because that's what it is, okay? And the first line, first a line, then a line, right, another line, then a square, the first line was the 14th Amendment. The second line was when they took over the Federal Reserve and therefore the government, and the third line was where they hid the original white citizens before the 14th Amendment as U.S. nationals. And that's mm-hmm. why that affidavit with the Secretary of State works like a snap, because the system is built legitimately on the fact that we're in this voluntary servitude, we're born into it, and they don't tell mm-hmm. us. And so that declaration to that specific person is the key to the matrix, really. And so that's what it is. I was given that on May the 1st of 2013.
Interesting date.
Yes, of 2013, of all the years, for God's sakes. And
yes.
I didn't know what to do with it at the time, but see, now I understand it better. I've had a couple of years to noodle on it, and I'm sure I don't know any of the nuances of it like these guys do. That was the most valuable concept, evidently, that was taken by the Crusades, and the first Crusade, when they slept, the Templars slept in Solomon's horse stables and found something evidently buried in there. Okay, uh-huh. That's the story. And that was the most valuable thing brought back to Europe. It's ruled Europe for a few hundred years with the Templars. Then they were put down and it resurfaced on May the 1st, 1776 with Weisskopf and Rothschild.
Sure.
And what it is in the Old West in our country, if you're going to keep horses or cows up, you put them in a four-legged corral. In Babylon, they only used three. And they used concepts instead of rails. And you're in a Babylonian triangle Freemason trap. The whole world is. That's what's going on, okay?
Why don't you shoot me a link to that?
I will after the show, but that's I'd like to talk to your guy too, if you could put me in contact with him, because I watched his about half of his film Hellfire, and I was absolutely enthralled.
Yes,
you get to a point.
Thomas Goodrich and Kyle Hunt. That film was amazing. Hellfire.
You can only stomach so much of that. I mean, it gets to a point where the atrocities, the carnage, the brutality,
exactly.
All of it. You just get to a point. It's like, oh, I watched the whole thing all the way to the end. No, thank you. You know, I got enough to get
sure.
the feel, and then your stomach just turns, and you get to resent these sorry bastards just a little bit more.
Sure. Well, you know, I have a friend that she gave that film to her neighbor, and her neighbor did watch it, and his response was, well, they had it coming.
Yeah.
Can you believe that people are so brainwashed? And even people who understand that the Holocaust was a hoax, excuse me, even people that know that, still think that the Germans are evil and still think that Hitler was evil.
I fight the battle all the time, even with people that I consider to be intelligent and even somewhat open-minded. It frustrates the pee waddling out of me, but I just keep putting one foot in front of the other because I know I got the sword of truth, okay? And what World War II really was the war to make Europe safe for communism.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what else would you like to elaborate on? I don't know where we've been. Anything you'd like to add, Deanna? I really am enjoying the conversation.
Excuse me.
You got a little tickle in your throat there.
I have had a tickle, yes. Well, gosh, I've got my four books open, and you talk about, yes, World War II. World War II was definitely a project, an operation to make the world safe for communism and or Marxism. And we have to also understand that there was a revolution in Europe in 1848, and that it was not successful. Excuse me. And so there was about 500,000 revolutionaries who came to this country and participated in the so-called Civil War.
And that was the Napoleonic era, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was when the Russians, the Tsars, came down and helped defeat their first quest for a new world order. And that's one of the other reasons they hated the Tsars so much.
Sure, but it was after that. It was 1848.
Okay.
And so then all of these Marxists came over to this country, And, of course, Marx and Engels absolutely cheered for Lincoln. They thought he was doing a wonderful job, which he was, because he was certainly, well, 700,000 people, or at least 700,000 people died during that war. And as we already stated, it allowed corporatocracy to take hold in this country. And, of course, we know who is in charge of all the corporations. And when you talk about the Federal Reserve, the Congress of the United States, we often hear that there's a myth that says, oh, it was during the Christmas break and they were all out on vacation break, on holiday break, and so there were just a few people who passed the Federal Reserve Act. That is not true. There was a majority of Congress there. They voted on the Federal Reserve Act. It was passed. It was signed. And they have the ability, the capacity, and the jurisdiction to get rid of that act. But they're too much involved in what is going on. They're as much of a problem as the Jews.
Well, you
because,
know,
the Jews own Congress.
Yes, they do. They control it totally. And, you know, I came across an old quote of Lincoln's the other day that said, I've got two armies in front of me, one the Southern and the other the bankers, and it's the bankers I fear the most. And you get back in and see what Lincoln did really was assume the position of a despot. I mean, he revoked habeas corpus. He literally took mm-hmm. over. I saw a cartoon from those days in an article the other day that showed all the stuff he was doing at one time and what he was looked at least in that caricature. And it's pretty clear that he just really took the reins of the despot. Very interesting, and you get into some of the Southern stuff, and it's just lately I've understood all of the dialectics that they set up and use, because you get into the Southern, let's say, hierarchy, and you find a real rotten guy named Judith P. Benjamin, who
right.
evidently had sugar in his britches when he took over the Secretary of War. The generals almost had an open revolt, and only he stayed in it 6 months, and then he ended up leaving
with the gold.
Well, yeah, and then going into getting smuggled
to England.
an island in the Caribbean, where the Brits sent a special warship alone to pick up him and take him back, and he died one of the Queen's highest chancellors. That's
exactly.
Judith P. Benjamin. Now, obviously, there's a snake in there many times over.
Exactly. And he was put in that position. Well, in fact, a lot of the Freemasons went south, and they became part of the hierarchy to make certain that the South lost.
Yeah, they married them into the hierarchy in some of the old plantation families and stuff. I've read some of that from in the Louisiana area, some examples. But they're so devious, and they're so cunning, and they're so shrewd, and it's all this attitude of whatever's good is just the opposite that we do. And,
sure.
Man, it's so prevalent when you start going back and looking at the real history through all of this era. And, of course, the South at that period of time had the other, his probably cohort in crime, General Albert Pike, who founded the Scottish
sure.
Rite Freemasonry in that now familiar town of Charleston, where they pull false flags, to set up what we're going into right now, the third war between Islam and Christianity. And just even by those headlines in the previous news break, Deanna, they're doing one hell of an exemplary job.
Exactly, yes. And, of course, that's always been their way, divide and conquer and slaughter. And slaughter is always part of their conquering.
It's blood. That's a blood sacrifice.
Yes, yes. Which you can also include abortion in that.
Absolutely is what it is. Child
mm-hmm.
sacrifice. The Canaanites that were outside Jerusalem, in those days, they had a big statue and it was engineered such that the hands laid outstretched in front of it, and people would bring their firstborn child and put it in there. The hands would then lower into the statue, and there was a fire where they would be cremated, and they would blow the trumpets outside the temple so that the cries couldn't be heard. That's what's going on right there, except back then they burned them, and now they buy them, sell them so they can buy Lamborghinis.
Well, and the parts, you know, with Planned Parenthood, this latest revolution about Planned Parenthood, that they are actually harvesting organs from these aborted children to sell.
Well, that's what the director, they got her on tape, something about more livers or something, going, yeah, do it. I need a new Lamborghini. Yeah. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
It is. It honest to God is. And unfortunately, that's a lot of this prevailing attitude in the world in which we're forced to live right now. Now, hopefully we're going to come through some changes, and it is going to be a biblical type revelation event. Babylon, oh Babylon the Great, has fallen in an hour. Please hurry.
Right. Okay.
But boy, we live in some hellacious times, and it's hard enough to deal with it. Not understanding it, but if you have a little understanding, and I'm sure you'll agree with this, you become empowered.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we try and do with this audience, because they're gravitated to the message from the book and all the stuff I've been teaching for so many years now, and people understand it, and they start realizing the importance of it, and as you go through those fear barriers, you become empowered.
Exactly. Sure. And education is empowering, and we all need to do that. And you know, it's very interesting. We think of the founding fathers, like George Washington and all these wonderful people. Well, when you really look at it, Jewish power with the American government actually began in August 1790 with President George Washington, a year after his inauguration. And he went to Newport, Rhode Island.
The slave capital of the whole country at that point.
Yes, absolutely. And the Jews from the local synagogue handed him a letter praising, and I quote, the God of Israel, unquote, for establishing an unbiased government. And Jewish religious schools still study his eloquent response, which was essentially a grant promising Jewish freedom. And the United States is actually the very first country that granted freedom. And he wrote, the government of the United States of America, which gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens and giving it all, on all occasions, their effectual support, unquote. And with this president setting letter, it was the first he was the first national leader in 17 centuries to award or regard the wandering Jews as free and equal fellow citizens.
Well, he got a little caught in his equivocation there, because he said something about being good citizens. And they come back with their little cold nidre oath and stuff and go,
sure,
we're land sharks. That's according to this doctrine we live by. So we're being good citizens when we absolutely decimate your country, steal everything you got, put you in slavery, and suck your essence.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So it's this equivocation thing, and the way you look at it and the way they're oriented, that's why I know how important all that stuff is for us to understand. You know, I was talking to one of my co-hosts, very, very learned guy on Friday's, Brent Winters, absolutely fabulous. And I was trying to explain some of this to him, and I said, well, you gotta be like Sun Tzu. Know your enemy. And so you gotta think like them. He goes, I don't wanna think like them. I said,
right.
You don't have to think like them. You just have to know how they think.
Exactly. Exactly.
We call it here at the Radio Ranch, fine tuning your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can get these very, you know, here's another example, and I use it in that video. We all call it an illusion, and that word works, and that really is what it is, okay? But to fine-tune your thinking on it, think of it as a simulation, like a flight simulator, like the pilot that's going to fly the first new multi-gazillion-dollar deal. He doesn't take it up and take it for a spin. He goes into a flight simulator and gets trained on it, and everything's simulated right there. They have simulated reality.
Mm-hmm.
And you're running on a parallel government, and the proof is right in the Constitution. The 13th Amendment allows voluntary servitude by omission, and it specifically uses the word there.
Mm-hmm.
The 14th Amendment is singular, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. There's your parallel governments right there.
Sure.
So anyway, it's very interesting. Anything? We got a couple of minutes here before the break, Deanna. What else direction would you like to go? And I guess we can chime the phones in and see if anybody's got any comment, anything to add, anything to distract, or you just want to call us names, or hell, maybe Russell Estes would like to call.
Well, that would be nice. That would be very interesting.
He's never called me. They won't touch me with a 10-foot pole. I can call them every name under the sun, and I have in their own language because I know a little bit of it. They will not touch my work or this topic or me or anything else, which is a good feeling to have. It's like kryptonite to super ferrocyte.
Ah, good.
So
I guess that's something that we all need.
Well, absolutely. That's why I get up here and, you know, try and teach this and get people turned on, adjust your thinking, bring you into reality, show you what they're doing to you and how they've done it, and even more importantly, how to easily get out of it by their own rules, and they can't say boo about it. So that's the whole focus of the show. Listen, let me add something else. You'll find this great. I've never done a book thing before. It's very difficult. It's very labor intensive. Do you know who, and it was after the fact we find out, you know who my publisher is?
Who?
Victor Ostrovsky.
Ah.
He's got a little,
that is
in that niche.
Yes.
And he's a pretty darn good guy, man. I've had a
talk
to him a couple of times. I probably should get him on the show. I used to talk to him, threaten him about getting him on. Maybe we'll do that one day. But we didn't find out till after we'd already signed up and had that going on. And I just thought that was such a wonderful irony. For those who don't know who Victor Ostrovsky is, we'll fill you in on the other side when Deanna Spingola and I get right back. They're singing, Deanna. We gotta go.
All right.
Real people, real radio.
Initiating the truth frequency.
This is Truth Frequency Radio.
Population keeps on bleeding. Nation bleeding. Still more. It's funny, skies are sunny, bees make honey, who needs money more for me?
Yeah, I let that play a little bit there, Deanna, and then he yells just here in a second, oh, yeah. Yeah. And it fades off into the background. That's what we're trying to do, is change the world just a little bit, and the way you got to do it is to change one person at a time. And then my hopes and prayers are, Deanna, that the 100 monkey theory will kick in.
Indeed.
So we'll see. For the audience to pick up right where we left off, that Deanna and I were laughing about after From Sovereign to Serf was placed and it came out, and all the ballyhoo of a 8 or 10 month talk up to the actual event of publishing it, it ended up in a self-publishing outfit called thebookpatch.com, and after the fact, I find out that the owner is Victor Ostrovsky, this guy named Victor Ostrovsky. For those of you in the audience who don't know who Victor is, he's Canadian, that was at one point a line Mossad officer. back in some of the, 20 years ago or more, and wrote about some of the dirty things they did to Libya, etc. Wrote two books about it. They got quashed immediately. I remember I bought one of them in Atlanta at a bookstore for like $1.50, right shortly after it was out, okay? By Way of Deception, I think, was the book. And Victor turns out to be one heck of a good guy, and it's interesting talking to him. So anyway, where would you like to go from here? I did open up the phones. If anybody wants to call in with any questions for Deanna or myself, 866-37-TRUTH. Deanna, where would you like to go from this point?
Well, we could talk about, I was on with John Stattmiller last night, and we were talking about the black-white situation in this world. And we didn't really go into it in depth, and I did not mention also the fact that the media is really promoting this separation and this dissension. And not only is the media doing it, but keep in mind all the things that have occurred since Obama was placed into the White House. And remember the Trayvon Martin episode and all of that, and his comment, well, he could have been my son. And, of course, they showed the picture of him being when he was younger and more innocent looking. And so you have a president that I believe that was placed in the White House, not only to decimate the economic situation or further decimate the economic situation, but also to provoke a black-white war.
And don't forget Muslim, because that's in there in the mix,
sure,
too. And
oh,
there's
absolutely
no doubt that he's groomed for that. They've been Manchurian candidating him since he
yes.
was a little old youngin for this very role right there. And, of course, what they're doing is they're always using dialectics. It's always this trap, this first a line, then another line, then a square. So, you know, the white, the black, boom, and the Mexicans or the browns or the Christians and the Arabs and the Jews. Boom. It's always this three-sided, what they call sacred geometry, using these concepts and blocks and old resentments and hatreds mm-hmm. as catalysts on this divide and conquer thing. And it's
right.
pretty obvious that the Civil War II is being set up right now. You mentioned Trayvon Martin. You remember all that? Yeah, well, let me tell you what I also remember. I also remember all the black-on-white crime that doesn't get covered by these creeps.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was an elderly lady, I think she's like, I don't know, in her mid-80s, that I believe it was four black men assaulted her in her home with her husband watching, raped her. Never a single mention of it.
Nope.
In the newspaper.
The examples are horrendous and legion, okay? And
exactly.
When you understand who is doing it, what their history is, how they do it, it's pretty, and the agenda that you know that they've walked and they're planning, at least generally, it's pretty easy that they become almost predictable. That is the one way I found to beat them, Deanna, is that combination right there and having enough time to get out in front of them. Because the one thing that they don't have is speed. They have to use deception, lies, and stealth. And that mm-hmm. includes programming and all the stuff that they do have done to people and that we all fight on a daily basis. But that's the one day you can beat them. The problem with people that are just waking up and coming to that realization right now is you don't have the time.
Right, because you're so busy trying to take care of your family, maybe holding down two jobs, and simply they... Well, the other problem, too, is that people typically adopt talking points from somebody that they view as an authority, even though that authority may be, well, an operative.
Exactly. Man, they use that expert platform absolutely flawlessly.
Right.
Defer to the experts. We always defer to the experts, defer to the experts. Yeah, well, all the experts are bought and paid for, and they're in the same damn camp.
Sure. And have you noticed also that the good role model blacks such as Bill Cosby have been, well, totally marginalized and vilified. I mean, what was that all about? When you have 20 years after the alleged attacks on several women, all of a sudden you have all these women coming forward and claiming that he drugged them and had sex with them. And he was one of the role models, and he was never, well, remember his program, he was Dr. Huxtable. And people who viewed that program saw it not as a black-oriented program, but as a family program, and it was applicable to black, white. It was just a program. Nobody ever thought, well, oh, this is how black people live, or this was a program for black people. I mean, it was a family program. Correct?
Yes, it was, and I remember it very well while you were talking about it, Dr. Huxtable. I never watched that stuff. I don't watch TV like that.
But, I don't either.
But I knew it was there, and of course, sure. You're right about discrediting. Fortunately, I'm going to cough here. Excuse me. Fortunately,
bless you.
Thank you. Fortunately, they haven't been able to discredit some of the Walter Williams and some of the other real notable black people, because there's some really notable black minds and black people that have morals and ethics, and they don't like living in the ghetto either, okay? And you can go back, I heard this quote from Dr.
Exactly.
Schweitzer years ago. Who was the Brit guy that lived down there in Africa for so many years, pioneered a lot of that stuff. And one of his quotes was, these two races cannot live together. All right. And I think that we've at least done some semblance of a job of doing that, but they denigrate the whole thing. And when they have people that rise up from their own ranks, and the one I would mention is one of your local people up there who I happen to really admire, and that would be Louis Farrakhan. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And that when they do get Louis Farrakhan shut down in the DC years ago, almost all of the ghettos and the drug dealing and all that, and boy, they put a stop to that real quick.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's another individual that I've chatted with. She has a program on RBN, and that's Dr. Jennifer Daniels. And she grew up in a ghetto in Syracuse, New York. And she had wonderful grades. She went to Harvard. She got excellent grades at Harvard. She went to the Pennsylvania School of Medicine and Wharton Business College at the very same time.
Holy smokes.
And so she did what she had to do, and she went back. Her intention was to go back to the ghetto and practice medicine. But the practice of medicine, allopathic medicine, is a big farce. Allopathic medicine kills about 880,000 people per year. It is probably the most hidden way of the depopulation program in the United States. And she figured, well, I really have to be efficient with my patients, because if I don't help them, they are going to get even. And so she practiced more natural medicine, and then she, because she was also had a degree from Wharton Business College, she went against a bond issue that the governor of New York had. He made a deal with the feds that they were going to give all this money to create, I'm not sure what the project was. But she said, wait a minute. You've got, the bank is going to lend $300 million, and the taxpayers are going to have to pay for this, and it's going to benefit just a particular entity. And so she had a bunch of her patients, a bunch of the people in the ghetto, write letters, and kind of put a kibosh on that. The other thing that she did in the ghetto was that she, around her where she lived, she was encouraging her patients and the people in her community to paint, to build houses. She said it soon took on the appearance of the suburbs. And they didn't like that.
They don't like that at all.
The powers that be did not like that, because what they want to do is keep the blacks in the ghetto where they can control them, where they can send in the drugs. That, I mean, they don't get that stuff, it is sent into them. This whole war on drugs, it's as phony as the war on cancer and the war on poverty. It just doesn't work. What it does do is get a lot more people on illegal drugs. And so she actually had to flee the country because they put her on the terrorist watch list. They also withdrew her license to practice medicine. And the government, it was the government that did this. The government also put her on do not employ list. They were after her. She felt that she had to leave the country in order to exist, which is what she did.
Well, I left 7 years ago, and I have not been back, and I'm going to tell you, as I tell the audience all the time, I consider it to be the smartest decision I made in my adult lifetime, really. I can only imagine the pressure cooker that you folks are in up there living there, okay? I mean, I see the headlines, I know what's going on, I know what my mental state was when I was there, and the reasons that I ended up deciding to leave and moving down here in Southern America. But, it's unbelievable because I tell people this if they're considering leaving. It'll, wherever you decide to go and light, it'll take you a year to a year and a half to mentally unwind from being in the condition you're in right now.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And you won't realize it. I didn't believe that when people told me at the time, but looking back now, I can see that's absolutely true because I can see the difference. And it's a real refreshing difference not to have those pressures on you and all that stuff. And it gives me a better platform to be a commentator and a teacher, really. So it's all worked together very well. I'm very grateful. But I was not familiar with her story. Does she publicly say where she moved to?
She is in Panama.
Okay, she went to Panama. A lot of people are choosing Panama. It's an interesting country. I don't like that climate myself, but more power to her.
There's two climates there. There's it's really cold, and then where it's the beaches, and it's warm, and it's in the jungle, and she's in that part.
Yeah,
but she said when she first went down there that she felt euphoric. That she felt free and unencumbered.
That's exactly what I say. And, you know, if you get into the legal end of this, freedom and liberty, the best way I ever heard it expressed in the genius of this guy, Blackstone, he put that whole big concept into one word, locomotion. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ability to go from point A to point B unimpeded. And when you land in these countries down here outside of the U.S., prevailingly, I'm virtually positive, there are no stop signs. And the prevailing rule is you yield to the right. So you've got personal responsibility from the minute your feet hit the street, in essence. And, it's much freer. You don't have any worries about the cops banging the door in with a SWAT team or any of that other crap. And it's been a wonderful change. I mean, it's been great for me. The gauge personally that I use is personal growth. I think that's one of the most important things. And I've gone through more personal growth in the last 7 years than I had in a long time. And it's been cool. You know, I can butcher another language pretty good and, you know, different cultures, different ways of doing things. And they just do things different. They approach life and things different. And in my country, I'm gonna get off on this, but just a discussion topic that's kind of interesting is this is, they honor siesta. And so what it does is it puts a whole different shift on life because you basically live a double shift.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mentalities are different, and it's a whole, you know, it's manana. Oh, it's not that important. The government offices and the banks close at 1 o'clock and they don't reopen till the next day.
Wow.
In January, virtually the whole government, except for just a few needful officers, shuts down and the whole country goes on vacation for a month. I mean, they just do things differently, and it's been a real refreshing change for me. I've grown a lot, and it stimulates your thinking, and it's been a cool experience. So anyway, I salute this doctor and her efforts, and I'm sorry all those things happened to her, but obviously she's rebounded, and that's what they do to people. They don't want anything improving those people's lives because they're going to use that. They don't want the black people raised up because they're lowering the white people down to that level.
Exactly. Yes. And that is what the whole Civil War was all, the so-called Civil War was about, is to make everybody slaves.
Yep, that's exactly what it was. It set up a secondary subsidiary political status, and then over a number of years, then they slammed everybody into it. And the thing about this, if you get the legal thing about this, you know, you get back to contracts. Babylonian law is all based on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they've done, instead of taking a contract like, yes, I'll do that here, I'm going to sign that, they've taken out of the feudal era this dastardly contract called an oath of fealty, which has a really interesting little sidebar to it, is that if your parents were in that condition and you were born, you were born into the same condition.
Yes.
So they've had generations of people born into servitude, and then they come back very deceptively and ask you, they say, Deanna, are you still in voluntary servitude under the scope and purview of the 14th Amendment? And you say, yes, I'm a resident, or yes, I'm a citizen of the United States, which that legally means. And then you sign something. Now they've got your consent, and it legitimizes the
Sure.
That's how it's laid out. They're about slick as bus station chili, I'm going to tell you. It's taken me over 20 years to figure this thing out, and it is absolutely only Beelzebub could have come up with this.
Right. And it's been incremental.
Always.
And if you look at the things that happened under FDR, formalization of the, he recognized the Soviet Union within just a couple of weeks of taking office. I mean, just look at the whole government practically, was staffed with communists. And so it was a terrible, terrible situation. And of course, if you look at the difference between the United States in the 1930s and Germany at the same period of time, Hitler put all these people back to work. He put 6 million people back to work within a year. And meanwhile, back in the United States, people were still standing in soup lines.
He did to Germany, and the threat that he was going to make all Europe that way bountiful by going back and cutting the usurers out scared the pee waddling out of these people.
Oh, absolutely.
Have you ever seen the book, one of the early ones that's so instrumental in my understanding? It's the collective 31 or 33 of the collective speeches of Congressman Lewis T. McFadden.
Yes.
Have you seen that book? There's a lot of answers in there, okay? And on speeches that were from the floor of the House of Representatives, they didn't have special orders and video cameras back then because it's got applause and stuff where the people in the chamber broke out in applause at different things he was saying. In a reference to that in that book that I included in my book that was a reference, Deanna, to a speech that was given, I believe, December 33. This, you'll find this interesting because it was in your town, in front of the American Association of Colleges and Law Schools by the head legal counsel of the agency they used to run a bunch of these commies in on us, the Department of Agriculture, where they ran Harry Dexter White and Hiss and all those guys came in through there. Okay. By their counsel in front of that August body, do you know when they held their convention that year, Deanna?
No.
December the 30th in Chicago.
Ah.
Now, where would you take a national convention of American colleges and universities and put it on New Year's Eve weekend? It's the only year in the history of that organization that's ever been done. Do you know why? Because that little Jew guy named Frank got up and gave a speech called Experimental Jurisprudence and the New Deal. And when mm-hmm. I first found that and hunted it down, I saw it in that quote one day and said, I bet I need to look for that. Well, somebody went and found it. I sent it to, I was doing shows with Al Addisk at that point. I sent it to Al Addisk and he read it. He said, Roger, that's the most damning government document I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they were pulling this switch and that's how they did it. And you can go in and look at the telltale clues like, oh, when was that speech? December the 30th?
Right. Well, they always do these kinds of things, when people are busy, doing other things, they release, news that is very applicable to like the vaccines. You know, they announce that the vaccines, that something, I can't remember the exact document that they released. It was a joint document talking about the mercury in vaccines, and that they were going to pull it out. But they always release it when people are doing other things, like on the 4th of July or something like that. And they do it. Deliberately.
Deflection, deflection, deflection. That's one
sure.
of the strong arrows in the psychopath's quiver. Deanna, we got one of our old friends of the show, an FOS. This guy is, I call him Chris from Lost Wages. And I think he's joined
wonderful.
Us. Are you there, man? Oh, Chris. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll keep the line open from what I can see, and if he wants to chime in when he can,
okay.
I guess he will, and others, obviously, he's called your show, too.
Oh, and absolutely. He's a wonderful guy.
He's one of our faves, and
yes.
All his little emails with his word etymology.
Oh, isn't he marvelous?
Yeah, he is. Are you there, Chris, or not? Well, man, you must have your mute button on or something. So, Deanna, yeah, this is the way they do things. And that's the beautiful part about learning about them and understanding them is you can see things so easily when they happen that the ordinary people still living in the simulation we referred to earlier just don't even have a damn clue.
Am I touching now?
There you are. There's those.
Well, there you are.
There's those,
oh, there's Chris.
There's
Hi.
Those dulcimer tones.
Well, sometimes the equipment doesn't cooperate, sometimes outside forces, but this is like double mint gum, double my pleasure, double my fun. Two of my favorite radio hosts on one station, the Truth Frequency. Welcome to Truth Frequency, Deanna.
Well, thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to hear your voice.
Chris, I'm sorry I'm sorry I didn't get to you yesterday at that end there when Tom was on, so I want to just make that apology, but glad you called in. We're going to hit a break here in a second. Do you have something for us to noodle on as we sit through the wonderful news headlines?
Well, I thought if you'd let me know what day or give me a call when it's a good day, I have got a horrific tale of injustice that I want to share names, dates, times, places, and some of the intricacies of the legal system of jurisprudence you were just speaking of that are plotting against the American people and obstructing and denying all forms of due process and substantial justice.
Well, why don't you and I communicate on the side, and we'll schedule it for one day next week, okay?
You know how to get hold of me, so you let me know. I cannot send any substantive emails out. I have been obstructed. Microsoft is now impeding First Amendment access to communicate lawful, correct information via the Internet.
I was hacked. My email was hacked, yesterday, the day before, and, my email was totally unavailable. I just got it all fixed today and got a new password and everything, but boy, there's a lot of hacking going on, which is very inconvenient and it's going on all over from what I understand.
Boy, there's some thefts
and
stuff. There's some magnitude thefts and stuff that are unbelievable that are happening out there. And once again, it's these same, you know, band of,
mm-hmm.
of Babylonian rebel risers. There's a little music, Chris and Deanna and Roger, last segment, coming right back.
There's something happening here. We don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't take no trips on LSD. We don't burn our draft cards down on that main street. We like living right and being free.
Always, yeah, add yee-haw in there, Deanna. So, Deanna Spingola, my guest today, and our regular FOS, friend of the show, Chris from Lost Wages, in the last segment of the Radio Ranch. Man, I'm really glad to have both of you.
Well, thank you.
Go first.
Well, it was very interesting. I mentioned when we were chatting before the program about a gentleman by the name of Jeff Joe Black, and he was an independent Illinois candidate to the office of Senate of the United States of America. And this was to be in 2014. And I had him on my program. The very first time that I had him on my program was on February 3rd of 2011. And what he was doing was that he was objecting to the candidacy of Rahm Emanuel for mayor of Chicago, because he said, there was a lot of people who agreed with him. And Mr. Black was, he attended a meeting of the Chicago Board of Elections. There's a case file. And what occurred, and this is back in January 28th of 2011, is that he provided evidence that Rahm Emanuel, when he left to go to Washington, that he was no longer a resident, that he rented out his home, and that then he left. In other words, that terminated his residency in the state of Illinois. Then he came back and wanted to be the mayor. And Jeff Black and a lot of the other people who were with him, and there were other people who certainly supported his efforts, said, well, he has terminated his residency. He is not qualified to be the mayor. And he presented a lot of evidentiary materials. And I have I have 13 pages of evidentiary materials that Jeff Joe Black provided me. But anyway, what happened is, in the first court hearing, the people who had rented Rahm Emanuel's home said, oh no, he took everything. And there's nothing in the house. The next day they came back into court and they said, whoops, we found a whole bunch of his belongings down in the basement. A whole bunch of boxes down there.
They were in the corner under the gefilte fish.
Exactly. Yes, that's where they were. That is where they were. And so, what happened was that, Rahm Emanuel was approved to run for mayor, and Jeff Joe Black ultimately lost his job, he became homeless. He became homeless. And the next time that I had him on was in December of 2011. When he was homeless, he was staying with a friend for just to be on the radio program. And he had decided that he needed to leave the state of Illinois because, people were still kind of after him. And he had a bunch of stuff on an external hard drive. He wanted me to take possession of it, and which I did. I never looked at the hard drive. In fact, I didn't even take it out of my car. Then he left and he went to, a friend and I met him at the train station in Downers Grove. and we sat and talked in the train station. And then the next I heard from him, he said that he was going to Pennsylvania to live with his mother because he just wanted to get a fresh start and everything. And so I sent the external hard drive to him in Pennsylvania to his mother's address. And the next thing I know, there's a story about him being thrown off of an overpass into traffic.
That's quite interesting. You know, you can't dismiss the fact that Rahm is Zeke Emanuel, the Diet 75's brother,
exactly,
from Chicago.
Who promotes organ transplanting.
Well, of course, Chicago is the home of gangsterism politics, which, of course, is the Sotero and Jim Rayette and all the other groups, especially. And when they talk about burying the hatchet, we're not sure if it's B-U-R-Y or B-A-R-R-Y, as in Barry Sotero. They always want to do it between the forehead for everybody.
Sure. Well, I mean, look at Blagojevich. One day, he's just the governor of the state, and he said there was a situation with Republic Doors and Windows that wanted to get a bank loan from the Bank of America, and the Bank of America was just withholding loans from small business people. And so Blagojevich said, okay, well, the state of Illinois is not going to do business any longer with the Bank of America. And the next morning at 6 a.m., the cops were there at his door, and he was hauled off, and he is currently serving 14 years in prison.
Wow. Well, you know, I've been following this Rahm Emanuel slime for many years. He just popped up, this little short guy, and he's young, and he's brash, and he's abrasive, and all the things you read about him. But there at the first of Obama, or even back in the Clinton days, I think is when this story came out, they were in the White House. Of course, he was a political operative there. And, they're in the beautiful White House at some big, table, you know, like to have a meeting, and he pulls out a knife, a pointed knife, and every name, he'd come up, so-and-so, dead, boom, and he'd drive that knife into that table in the White House. Boom, 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 boom. I mean, he's a real psychopath, this guy. He's a real piece of work. Now, you follow his career, after he left there, they sent him up to Wall Street, and he got in with some company and gave him a whole bunch of money in a short amount of time, and then they moved him to, guess where? Freddie Mac.
Wow.
And I'm sure that his deal there was to go set up the whole front end of the housing catastrophe, where they're dumping those bonds back on them in the end, because the formula is privatize the gains and publicize the losses.
Exactly.
But he's a real piece of work.
Freddie Mac.
Go ahead.
Now, speaking of Freddie Mac, that'll have some relations to the story I'm going to tell you the next time we talk, because there's definitely a connection, a LexisNexis.
I guarantee you he was in on the front end of setting that thing up, and that leads you to, since that was old history, what's he doing now and where he is up there. And, Deanna, I mean, I've had the idea for a number of years, the feeling that whatever comes at us on this next false flag is your little locale up there is going to be someplace near Ground Zero, one of the important parts of it.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
That's rather discouraging, because there's some strong the answer that it's likely going to be some sort of a suitcase nuke or device of somewhat like that, maybe anthrax.
I'll be surprised if they don't throw everything but the kitchen sink at this one, because this is the big one. You know, they've all led up to this one, and it's kind of a do or die thing for them here.
Well, you know, when you look at the Obama history in Chicago area, Michelle Obama, I mean, we talked earlier in the program about the Obamas, improving the situation of the blacks, and they, A lot of the blacks had voted for them, or for him. And, but when you look at their history in Chicago, they were absolutely not doing anything at all to improve the situation of the blacks in South Chicago. In fact, in 1993, according to the records of the attorney, Michelle Obama Welsh became voluntarily inactive, and she wasn't authorized to practice law. So she became, she worked for the University of Chicago Medical Center, where she received an annual salary of $317,000 a year. She improvised a scheme in which they shifted the low-income charity cases to other area hospitals in order to make room for insurance-carrying patients to enhance the hospital's profitability. In other words, she didn't care about what happened to these people in the black community, in the poor black community. If they didn't have access to health care, it just didn't really matter to them. And, of course, that's when David Axelrod joined with the Obamas. Axelrod was Obama's senior advisor, and he masterminded the publicity behind the healthcare scam.
Can we say Mossad handler?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so it was a healthcare scam that the Obamas have now hoisted on the rest of the country. They tested it in Chicago, and now it's
That is fascinating. What a corollary that is. Now, she took the hospital, and they farmed out all the cases they would normally get to other hospitals and let them deal with it, and set that up as for the where they could cherry pick the insurance.
Exactly.
That's known as patient dumping. They had some that here in Las Vegas also, where they were shipping them off to California or Utah or other places, the mental institutions here, and they were very committed to that in Chicago. But that's part of the Hillary Care plan originally. It was reformed as the health care, and of course then you got Gruber who set that thing up.
Let's touch on back on our pal Ron. What was that? Ron,
I'm gonna check this out. I'll be back in a little bit.
Okay, well,
all right,
Deanna, I'll be right here for a few more minutes. It seems like when you're going back in this Rahm Emanuel character of Deanna, that I remember reading that his father, who I think still lives in the area up there, Stokey, that's a big Jewish area.
Yeah, Stokey. Right?
Stokey, whatever it is.
Stokey.
And that he was one of the guys that helped plan and implement the King David Hotel bombing.
Exactly. He was a part of the terrorist organization.
Airgun? Was it the Airgun or the Stern
Ergun.
Gang?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
here. It was Airgun.
These are a bunch of just badass, sorry-ass people that advance this agenda by absolutely killing, murdering, and just coming in and bulldozing anything they want. And they do it by manipulating these laws just like the Pharisees did and learned in Babylon. Except I think they took the Babylonian law and took it to a whole new level when they got it over there in Jerusalem for 500 years or so before Jesus came along. And they are absolutely wicked with it, and they're nothing, no new thing under the sun. That let me throw this at you because this is interesting. There's a word in the Bible. It's only used twice. It's called Korban. Okay. And it was in an article I read, and I'd never seen it before and didn't know what it was. And I did a little research on it and found out that Jesus railed against it because it overrode the law of Moses. And so I kind of knew that general bit, but I didn't understand it till this guy Brent Winters, I mentioned earlier, is my co-host on Fridays, was on, and he's written a Bible with like 12,000 footnotes. And so we're talking about that word Korban. And he goes, well, let me see what I wrote about it in my Bible. And what it was the way that they go in today and take our stuff legally are called self-help remedies, where they can just come in and grab stuff. okay? Mm-hmm. And its origin is the Babylonian merchant code, like with a car loan. It's got legitimacy. Because if they don't have time to go get on a court docket and do all this, you may be five states away by then. Okay? Mm-hmm. So they just come grab it when you don't make a payment. Those are called self-help remedies. Lien, levy, garnishment, and seizure. And that's what Korban was. The temple would corrupt the youth. Imagine that, huh? Corrupt the youth and get them to tell the scribes and the priests what valuables were in the house. And then the priests would come over in the house and say, those jewels are Korban. And they would take possession of them and take them back to the temple and sell them and use it to finance their social system.
Wow.
Guess what happened when you got baptized? They kicked you out of the social system.
Wow.
Same thing, see? I mean, it's just nothing new under the sun. I always thought that was real interesting to be able to put those dots together and see, we're dealing with the same, I call it the same pig. And they just put a different color tutu on it and a little different lipstick and just trot it right back out, see?
Sure. Well, you have to look at also the infiltration of the churches. I mean, we're talking about temples and whatnot. You have to really look at that. And the time frame, and also the tax status, and the fact that churches are now corporations. And when you look at the mother corporation, which is the United States government, and that is the head corporation, and has jurisdiction over the other corporations. So when you look at a church now that is a corporation, you say, okay, that's really kind of part of the United States government.
It is, and it is a government church. You know, it's funny how they dialectically change these things, but you got this mythical separation of church and state, which is an out-of-context statement from a Thomas Jefferson letter that their Freemason guy is the head of the Supreme Court, Justice Black, inserted into a Supreme Court decision, and then they use it as this expert, this authority. And that what they've done is exactly the opposite, because when they sign that corporate agreement and join in that 501c3 incorporated agreement, it's contract. Mm-hmm. And from then on out, two interesting aspects of that people may not know. I imagine this audience does, but it's worth reiterating. Once they get into that agreement, then the jurisdiction attaches, and there's certain things they can't do. Okay, they have a duty not to do, and one of those is 23 or 24 things that you preach against the pulpit against public policy. Have you ever seen that list?
No.
It's like you can't do anything political, you can't talk about abortion, you can't do all these public policy things, which is laws for the serfs. Okay, and then also you get the tax deduction, which you touched on earlier, when you tithe to the church, and now they know who all the tithing Christians are.
Because
they deduct it on their tax returns. So
it's
an insidious, insidious plan. These are absolutely hideous, deplorable people.
And of course, the other thing, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No,
interrupt.
No, that's okay.
The other thing is that, okay, you don't talk about, in church, you don't talk about abortion, you don't talk about some of the political issues, but it is okay to be pro-war and to get those evil Nazis or to get those Muslims.
Or, of course, or let the black pastors that are in the churches like Obama's church up there in your area, they can talk all they want to about this stuff from the pulpit. You can't.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
You know, some pigs are more equal than others.
Yes. Yes. And honestly, some of the things that he said were quite right. Right? Right did say
yes,
some things.
It was right, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. He said some things that were applicable. And speaking of deaths, there were some people in that church who were known to be homosexual who were murdered.
That's correct.
Because of their affiliation with a certain other person that went to that
church. A bathhouse is really popularized by people such as your mayor up there these days.
Exactly.
Is that not correct?
Yes.
I'll tell you what, if it's not Sodom and Gomorrah, man, they've done one hell of a job replicating it in a modern era, I'm going to tell you.
Absolutely.
Those news stories you hear, oh, I will not refuse to issue. They had the first, they said it's a monumental event. Boy, it's monumental, but don't you dare think of that in a positive tone. It's
sure.
Monumental in the time and the day in which we live, and all these things that are circling, you know, talk about wars and rumors of wars.
Mm-hmm.
Lord have mercy. These refugee problems, same source problems, all the things that are happening, so they can flood these countries with all these immigrants, and it
sure.
gives them one more big powder of dynamite to light.
Exactly. Absolutely. You are totally correct.
So that's the horror that awaits, I'm afraid, so much of the world. And it's just, it's catastrophic and it's heartbreaking to see. And of course, they use those emotions against you because psychopaths don't feel them. But they, all this stuff that's going on over there in Europe, man, and, it's just, it's almost overwhelming. Hell no, it is overwhelming, Deanna.
Yes. Well, you know, I was listening, where did I hear this? That they were giving us, that, the poor Germans were being kicked out of their homes to make room for the immigrants coming in.
I think we ought to put them in some of the synagogues, ought to take them in. What do you think?
Exactly. And yet, I mean, that is what happened to Germany during and after World War II, is that they kicked Germans out of their homes and turned those homes over to the Jews.
Oh, I'll bet the German people over there are just absolutely simmering mad.
Indeed. Absolutely. And they should be.
The Hungarians sure are.
Yes.
Yeah. They're more aligned with us politically on a lot of this stuff and fringe on the European thought, main thought bunch. And I like some of the things that guy that's their president's been doing over there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the media spins it so that people so that they can create our perceptions of everything and anything.
I've got a little prognostication here as we get towards the end of the show. I want to thank you again publicly, Deanna, for coming on. I really enjoyed the show today, and I'd love to have you back because these are real good discussions, and I think the audience really, you know, needs this kind of background conversation and color to really understand the period that we're going into fully.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do a little anticipatory speculation here. There's been an event recently over the last month or so, I'll bet you've heard about it, was the discovery of the Nazi gold train.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now, evidently the guys that found it and did all the bird dog work and everything have been working to cut a deal with the Poles to get a finder's fee percentage, but they think most of it will be put in a museum and whatnot. But my question is this, as we get close to that event coming up, because it looks like they found it, how loud do you think the scream's going to be? Ours, that's ours. You got to pay these victims. All the wailing and gnashing of teeth. They're going to be going after all of that stuff.
Sure. Well, there was actually a gold train, and it had the gold reserves of a whole bunch of people. We're talking in probably millions and millions of dollars. And, but a lot of that the treasure from that train, I covered this in my third book. It's called One Man Fighting, Two Men Looting, and Three Men Painting Rainbows. It's the name of the chapter. And Americans, you would not believe how much looting the American soldiers engaged in during World War II. And that's a chapter that you definitely want to read about. And but that gold train, let me just bring up some notes here.
You know what, Mark Twain, let me paraphrase Mark Twain here. I do it occasionally. It ain't what I know that's killing me. It's what I know that ain't so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. How true. How true. But this was actually called the Hungarian Gold Train, and it traveled under the fellow by the, it was an SS appointed Hungarian official, Arpad Toldi, T-O-L-D-I. And this was a plan to prevent the advancing Soviets from plundering their plunder. But anyway, the loot was labeled and packed and padlocked into 29 rail cars. And sources said, you know, give different numbers. But anyway, people were loading all of their treasures onto the train. And as I said, it was called the Hungarian Gold Train. And it traveled under Toldi's command. And they stayed just ahead of the Soviets. But a lot of that stuff, was placed into a warehouse in Salzburg. There were 850 chests of silverware, 5,000 hand-woven Persian rugs. There was alarm clocks, watches, cameras, bolts of cloth, underwear, top. I mean,
it was just all rolled
loaded,
up.
Yeah. Loaded. And they confiscated all this stuff on August 29th, 1975.
Well, hold on. We're going to have to leave it confiscated because we are whistling out of here. Deanna, thanks. We'll pick that up next time. We'll probably know more. People can find you over on Republic on Thursdays. Deanna,
yes.
Spingola, we'll have you back. And from the high deserts of Argentina, Buenos Tardes, Hasta La Vega,